Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the London School of Economics. And as on behalf of the Center for the Study of Global Governance, I welcome you all. We are tomorrow is the World Human Rights Day, as some of you are aware, and it is fitting, therefore, that on the eve of the World Human Rights Day, we have at the LSE, Pierre Sanet, who is Secretary General of Amnesty International. Now, in a sense, while he is important in many ways, I shall describe his many virtues. Of course, what really is important for me, anyway, is that he's just coming back to LSE. He is a LSE alumnus. 10 years ago, he was an MSc student here and got an MSc in Public Administration and Public Policy. So as I look at some of my students, I'm sure that they will come back in 10 years' time to give public lectures of equal importance, I hope. Now, so welcome to Pierre Sanet. Welcome back to the London School of Economics. Welcome back. Welcome to the Center for the Study of Global Governance. Pierre Sanet is a native of Senegal, as some of you may know, and very recently he was regional director in Western Central Africa for the International Development Research Center, which is a Canadian development aid organization, and he was in Ottawa. And as part of that outfit, he has done extensive work in West and Central Africa. I think, in a sense, it has been a very imaginative move on part of Amnesty, and they were lucky to have acquired Pierre Sanet as their Secretary General, because he brings to it an almost universal outlook, because his combination of African background, his academic work at LSE, his experience in Canada, and his commitment to development that he demonstrated, clearly make him an outstanding choice for Amnesty International. I need hardly say anything about Amnesty International, because in a sense it is simultaneously one of the most loved international charities on part of the people and one of the most hated charities on the part of governments. And there could not be a better recommendation than to be universally hated by all the governments of the world. I introduce you, Pierre Sanet. Thank you very much.
Particularly pleased to be speaking today at the London School of Economics, where, like Professor Desai just said, I was a postgraduate student in the mid-80s, and I'm especially honored to be sharing this platform with Professor Lord Desai, and very grateful indeed for his invitation. This college, as we all know, has a proud tradition of path-breaking and radical thought. And some of you may feel that the reputation that it acquired in the heady days of 1968 did not persist long after the rebels had left for jobs in the city. But I'm certain that the underlying determination not just to accept the intellectual orthodoxy of the day has survived, because this is precisely the quality that we need today to address the deep problems facing humanity. The old methods and concepts are proving incapable of responding to our needs, and I hope that some of the questions that I'll be raising tonight will be taken up by the Center for the Study of Global Governance and others at LSE, so that we can move towards the 21st century better equipped to avert some of the human rights disasters that threaten to overwhelm us all. Obviously, today is particularly appropriate moment to look at some of the key issues facing the world's human rights movement. December 10th tomorrow is International Human Rights Day, and this year marks the 45th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Universal Declaration was born out of the ashes of the Second World War, and it was inspired by two simple words: never again. Never again should the world witness so much horror and war. Never again should the world allow genocide and stand back while governments inflict terror on their citizens. And never again should human rights be abused on such a massive scale. The Universal Declaration was also inspired by hope. Hope that peace could prevail over war. Hope that basic decent standards could be promoted and protected. And hope that all people, whatever their race, color, religion, could live free from persecution, free from discrimination, and free from fear. And when the declaration was drafted, the world was divided by East-West rivalries, and much of humanity was still in colonial bondage. The rights of many nations, as well as minorities and women, were largely ignored. The dramatic changes that have taken place since 1948 have not made the declaration outdated or redundant. It remains the key starting point in any discussion on human rights because it contains profound truths about human rights and what is needed in order to protect them. Before the declaration, only a select group of people were considered worthy of being accorded human rights. Even the most progressive standards excluded much of humanity. The American Bill of Rights made no mention of slaves. The French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen forgot women. And around the world, the vast majority of people had no codified rights at all. It was only when nations collaborated after the Second War that the rights of all people were formally recognized. The ground had been laid by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his address to the American nation in 1941, who outlined four freedoms as essential to mankind. I quote, "The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitant everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armament to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation would be able to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor, anywhere in the world." This vision, fully reflected in the Declaration, was a broader and more balanced conception of human rights than ever before presented. It also formed the bedrock of the vast body of international human rights law, which has subsequently been developed. Today, 8 conventions and treaties codify the obligations of the member states of the United Nations, obligations to guarantee and respect the rights of the individual and peoples all over the world. And Roosevelt added, I quote, "This is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a world attainable in our time and our generation." That was Franklin Roosevelt in 1941. The sad truth is that 45 years after the Declaration was written, the world has singularly failed to meet the hopes that it raised. We are all aware of the headlines: ethnic cleansing, civil wars, rising racism, a quarter of the world starving, one in nine people living as refugees. And at Amnesty International, where I've been Secretary General for the past year, we deal every day with the individual human suffering behind the headlines. We see the mutilated bodies of torture victims in places such as Mexico. We hear of young girls who have been gang raped by soldiers in places such as India. We talk to people who have witnessed the wholesale destruction of their communities in places such as southern Iraq. I've just come back from Northern Ireland. There, our researchers speak to the families of young unarmed men who have been shot dead by undercover British soldiers. Soldiers who have never been held to account for their actions. As an organization which monitors, researches, and campaigns against specific human rights violations in all countries of the world, we are also painfully aware of the extent of the human rights crisis we now face. Our major campaign this year on political killings and disappearances shows that we are in danger of being overwhelmed by human disasters unless urgent and effective action is taken. 4 years ago, when the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, we were promised a bright new future, new accountable democratic governments, new prosperity, new cooperation between all governments of the world. But what do we see? Far from accountable democracies, we see the horror of civil war and governments resorting to old methods of repression. In the heart of Europe, we see neighbor killing neighbor. We hear of women being raped by former soldiers as well as strangers. We witness ethnic cleansing, an atrocity we believed would never happen again in Europe. Far from prosperity, we see even more people plunged into poverty, sickness, and despair. In the United States of America, the richest and most powerful nation on earth, mentally retarded prisoners are gassed, poisoned, or electrocuted for committing crimes in their youth. Almost all are poor, a disproportionate number are black. Even President Bill Clinton has had no qualms in using their cruel deaths to make political gains. Far from international cooperation, we see the world community floundering in the face of human rights disasters. In Angola, for example, the deep divisions fed by the old East-West rivalries have not been healed. Soldiers, armed and trained by both West and East, are today slaughtering their opponents and helpless bystanders. Tens of thousands of people have died in the conflict, and thousands have been deliberately killed by both sides. In every region of the world, it seems that human rights are being rolled back. Frustration and bitterness are fueled by economic policies which make the rich richer and the poor poorer. And governments seem unwilling or unable to do anything about it. But they are prepared to go to great lengths to cover up their crimes. They know that a bloodstained human rights record will damage their international image. Some turn to arm's length ways of achieving their aims. They set up or they back death squads and civilian defense forces to do their dirty work. Long-standing democracies such as India and newer ones such as the Philippines proclaim the sanctity of human rights while in the streets people are being extrajudicially executed by government or government-backed forces. Every year, thousands of people are assassinated in Brazil and Colombia. Even children whose only crime is their homelessness. Many governments set up phony human rights institutions to cover up crimes rather than to expose and punish the guilty. They use sophisticated public relation techniques to make sure that the sound bites sound right. They secretly sell weapons of destruction to dictators, gladly sacrificing profit for principle. Gladly sacrificing principle for profit. They defend allies while denouncing their foes, regardless of the truth about human rights. In China, home to nearly a quarter of the world's population, state terror continues 5 years after the crushing of a mass peaceful pro-democracy movement. Hundreds of thousands of people are incarcerated in work camps, administrative detention centers, and prisons. Thousands are executed every year. Yet, many governments turn a blind eye to such atrocities in their hunger to exploit economic opportunities. The hypocrisy of governments sometimes defies belief. For example, last June in Vienna, at the UN World Conference on Human Rights, South Korea Minister of Foreign Affairs declared, I quote, "I am happy to report to you that human rights have finally come of age in Korea. I stand before you representing a nation and a people who can proudly say that truth, freedom, and democracy have at last triumphed in their country," end of quote. Back to reality, a few weeks later, South Korean police arrested No Tae-hoon, one of the most prominent human rights activists in Korea. He was interrogated for 10 days, during which he was threatened and deprived of sleep. In October, after nearly 4 months in jail, he was released after being given a one-year suspended prison sentence under a law whose sole aim is to curtail free speech. The World Conference in Vienna exposed the enormous gap between what governments say and what governments do. While their representatives were paying lip service to universal human rights principles, the appalling rate of violations we record daily at Amnesty continued unabated. During the 2 weeks of the conference, at least 4,500 prisoners of conscience in 60 countries were languishing in jail. In the same fortnight, Amnesty was working on behalf of 11,000 people in 80 countries who were suffering human rights abuses. To our knowledge, during those 2 weeks where government gathered to proclaim their attachment to human rights principle, at least 20 people were tortured to death, over 40 disappeared, and more than 100 were condemned to death. Who was responsible? Those same governments. Everywhere we look, it appears that the nation state is incapable of delivering what its people need and expect. Many are on the point of disintegration. Indeed, all states are under contradictory pressures. The globalization of the world economy continues apace. The debt burden and the world recession exact their toll. Massive international speculation and large foreign investment chase the best returns globally. Millions of people move across borders in search of a better life or any life at all. And the global communication network grinds human diversity into cultural uniformity. Everywhere, people feel powerless in the face of these global trends. And in reaction, they turn to their group for identity. Religion, race, tribe, nation, the ties of blood all take on a new importance. Global modernization, with its devastating economic and social effects, is resisted by those who have the least control over the process and the most to lose. Most intercommunal conflicts in Central and Eastern Europe and Africa, the growth of religious fundamentalism and sectarianism in the Middle East, North America, and parts of Asia, and the rise of the extreme right in Europe can be interpreted as expression of resistance to the global modernization process. The nation state cannot control these global trends. It cannot easily accommodate the demands of different groups living in the same country, and so the institution itself loses legitimacy. Everywhere we see both new and old nations straining under the pressure. We also see opposition groups increasingly resorting to violence to achieve their ends. And in the name of religion, justice, or nation, they too are bombing and maiming civilians who are simply trying to get on with their lives. The people of countries such as Algeria, Liberia, Peru, Sri Lanka, Sudan are paying the price. The question for us, therefore, is how to develop a global counter-movement that will protect all the rights of all the people from the global trends that threaten to destroy the very fabric of society in many countries. I believe that the concepts of security and development will require a new paradigm in which substantive participation at local, national, and international levels will become the primary goal and not an afterthought. It should integrate the values emerging from the human rights and other social movements that are developing worldwide. It should put the human being back as the subject of history. We have seen in recent years the growing pressure on the United Nations to solve the world's problems. No longer paralyzed by Cold War superpower rivalry, the UN was expected to become a far more effective force for peace and justice. The reality has been different. The UN is expected to deal with crises that are beyond its resources and are beginning to test its impartiality and credibility. It is finding itself drawn deeper into conflicts in which its neutrality is threatened and violence is turned against the peacekeepers themselves. Because so many hopes rest with the UN, it is hard to confront its failures. But when unarmed Somali civilians are shot dead by men in blue berets, that is failure. Just as shocking is the fact that the UN can hold detainees in Somalia without adhering to the most basic safeguards and standards, standards which have been adopted under United Nations auspices. Human rights organizations now find themselves faced with the task of monitoring the actions of the United Nations, just as we have to monitor the actions of governments. In this post-Cold War era, the UN is faced with some key questions that require clear answers. Does the UN exist to help people or to help governments? Should the UN protect and support governments and their current leaders, or should it press for the collective pursuit of goals for the peoples of the world, as set out in the Charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Can the peoples of the world reclaim their right to tell their representatives at the UN what they want the organization to do? Further, in the here and now, there are many issues that need to be addressed. The experience of Angola, Cambodia, and Somalia shows that unless the UN tackles human rights violations when they first occur, it will never achieve its stated aims of preventing wars and alleviating human suffering. The UN is ill-equipped to deal with civil conflicts, such as those raging in the former Yugoslavia. It lacks the expertise and material necessary to make an immediate and decisive impact. It is therefore always in danger of getting bogged down in dispute, which become more complicated with every passing day. It has frequently failed to understand the limitations of what its forces can achieve or to clarify its mandate. Humanitarian missions slide into peacekeeping operations, which, if there is no peace, may end up becoming peace enforcement operations. But trying to enforce peace in a civil conflict inevitably involves using violence. It also inevitably leads to charges of taking sides. The UN therefore risks losing its role as a neutral arbiter or a humanitarian agency, the very basis of its legitimacy when it intervenes in such situations. The role of the UN as a body which transcends individual states is too important to allow it to be undermined in this way. Other factors have also hampered the UN human rights efforts. One of the most important is lack of resources. For example, the United Nations Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances, which has done admirable work on behalf of victims, has a huge backlog of cases. It has a staff of 2, which was expected to deal with 17,000 cases received in 1991 alone. The scale of human rights disasters is certainly not reflected in the budgetary allocations at the UN. At Amnesty, we have a set of demands for all governments in relation to the international protection of human rights. We call on them to ratify all international human rights standards and treaties. Today, only 20 countries out of 181 have ratified all 8 instruments, and 19 countries have ratified none of them. If every government was publicly committed to these common standards, that would be an important first step. And these standards are developed by the government themselves. They must then act to implement them, because signed pieces of paper mean nothing unless there is a genuine will to abide by the pledges. We call on government to back their words by giving the UN adequate resources, including paying their assessed contributions in full and on time. They must also ensure that the resources are properly allocated and that the human rights program is given the staff and money to do its work. Work which involves matters of life and death every day. We asked them to support the proposal for a High Commissioner for Human Rights. This was a proposal that the World Conference asked the General Assembly to take up as a matter of priority. We urge the UN to ensure this post is established and is given the authority, mandate, and resources to address the gaps and failings in the UN human rights system. We also call on the UN and its member governments to ensure that human rights protection is an integral and key component of all peacekeeping operations. Human rights concerns must be addressed at the very start of such operations. All UN personnel must be properly trained and supervised to ensure they observe international human rights standards. In addition, when a peacekeeping operation withdraws, there must be adequate planning, evaluation, and follow-up to secure the long-term protection of human rights. We also demand that governments stop stalling on human rights issues. We ask them to open up their countries to impartial inspection. We call on them to stop ignoring the crimes of allies. We are not naive idealists. We know that governments are driven by political expediency and self-interest. We know that the very governments we are asking to solve the world's problems are, in many cases themselves, committing atrocities. So Amnesty's work, as always, will continue to focus on individual victims and individual governments. Human rights violations are not an inevitable part of modern society. They are the consequence of decisions taken by state officials. These officials must be forced to change their ways. We demand an end to impunity for the perpetrators of human rights violations. The killers and torturers must be brought to justice. The truth must be exposed. Only then can the cycle of violence be stopped. Every government must send a clear message to all its officials and agents that human rights abuses will not be tolerated. Every soldier, every prison warden, every police officer must know that they will be held to account for their actions. We call on governments to work in partnership with human rights organizations. They must allow activists to work freely without intimidation or fear. Every government should make human rights education an integral part of the training of all state officials, as well as a component of its education system. Every child and every adult must be aware of what human rights they are entitled to and what they can do if they are violated. We demand that all governments extend their protection to those seeking refuge at their borders. We are constantly appalled by governments that try to hide behind legal technicalities to deny desperate individuals their right to safety. Just because a plane has stopped to refuel in a third country, they pretend that they have no obligation to offer sanctuary to a victim of torture. And in this respect, the wealthiest nations are most at fault. As you can see from this list of demands, there is still a lot to be done. However, it is important for us to recognize how far human rights issues have progressed in the past 45 years. A huge body of international human rights law has grown out of that original Universal Declaration. Almost all governments of the world have publicly committed themselves to abide by at least some of these standards. A new generation of rights, covering everything from development to the environment, has emerged. New avenues of redress for specific violations such as disappearances or torture have been developed. Today, human rights concerns are almost always on the agenda in international relations. This would have seemed utopian half a century ago. The most important development, however, has been the dramatic growth in the world's human rights movement. The spread of democratic institutions in recent years, despite their fragility, has opened doors for new human rights groups in many countries. This new strength was reflected at the World Conference in Vienna. While diplomats mouthed adherence to human rights within the conference chambers, human rights activists from all over the world passionately pursued their urgent concerns. There were over 1,500 organizations from every part of the world. They represented a vast range of interests, including indigenous people, women, children, the disabled, and many others. They came together and they worked together, and they showed in practice what universality and multiculturalism can mean. They proved that the human rights movement is a force to be reckoned with. Amnesty, with its 1 million plus members, is proud to consider itself as part of this movement. our experience shows that governments do respond to pressure. One mark of this is the extent to which almost all declare their respect for human rights. Another is the way some governments do try to clean up their acts when the international community shuns them. At Amnesty, we see some of the rewards of concerted pressures. Prisoners of conscience are sometimes released when the government is flooded with letters. The lives of prisoners on death row are sometimes reprieved when pressure is brought to bear. Long-term disappeared do sometimes reappear after years of campaigning, like in Morocco. So what could the agenda for human rights, for the human rights movement in the 90s and beyond, what could such an agenda be? Let me go back to where I started, that is, with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Declaration is a common goal for all peoples. It is a basis for action for every individual and every organ of society. It is the basis of action for us, the peoples of the United Nations. A broadly defined human rights movement must cover issues which are local and which at the same time transcend nations. It must tackle areas which are linked and interdependent, such as human rights and development, human rights and the environment, human rights and security, because it is a movement that is centered on the well-being of man and society. The movement, therefore, must work towards the realization of Article 28 of the Universal Declaration. This states that everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in the Declaration can be fully realized. To achieve these goals, the movement must take up many challenges. It must disseminate the Universal Declaration. If people do not know their rights, they cannot defend them. How many people have actually read the Declaration or are familiar with its 30 articles? How many in this room? How many people can never read the Declaration because it still hasn't been translated into their language? How many of the hundreds of millions of illiterate people in the world have never even heard of the Declaration? How many schools and colleges teach their students about the Declaration's principles and objectives? Does the LSE, for example? No idea. We know that the answers to these questions fall dismally short of what is needed. Knowledge of human rights empowers people. It allows them to stand up for their rights and protect them. We therefore need to promote through education a much stronger culture of human rights. The human rights movement must also keep in mind Article 1 of the Declaration. This asks the people of the United Nations to take the progressive action necessary at the national and international levels to secure human rights and, I quote, to do so in the spirit of brotherhood, end of quote. To achieve this spirit of brotherhood, our movement must learn to work together much more effectively than it has done in the past. There are thousands of organizations around the world and millions of people involved in one way or another in work that is related to fundamental human rights. They come from different cultures, they have different goals, different ideologies, different ways of working, different focus. We must all learn how to complement each other's work. For example, development organizations and human rights groups must work more closely together to ensure that all rights are considered and promoted. We know that we have to improve our communication, share our skills and information, and call on each other for help. But we can also go beyond and develop more strategic approaches to specific country situations. Moreover, as I said before, we need global solutions to today's problems. Just as in the 19th century, social movements arose within nations to protect human rights, today we need global social movements to tackle the devastating conditions that threaten the lives of so much of humanity. We have recently seen two initiatives in this direction. The first was the Earth Summit held last year in Rio de Janeiro. It brought together heads of state, prime ministers, heads of the World Bank and GATT, and non-government organizations to discuss ways of protecting the environment. A new vocabulary emerged, which recognized the need to balance economic development with the environmental needs of present and future generations. An action plan was produced, and significant financial pledges were made. I'm not saying that the summit answered all of the world's environmental problems, far from it, but it did represent a step forward. The UN World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna was an opportunity to begin a similar process in relation to human rights. But as Amnesty said at the time, it turned out to be a missed opportunity. Unlike the Rio summit, there were no world leaders present, no new concepts that emerged. The action plan was merely a set of admonition and recommendation. No money was pledged, and human rights groups, the very people with the knowledge and commitment to make a key contribution, were banned from the all-important drafting process of the Vienna Declaration. It is therefore up to the activists on the ground to develop a genuinely global movement that can challenge the way the world is run. To achieve this, our movement must develop and share a common vision. A vision of a world in which all human rights are respected and where it is each person's obligation to see to it that they are. We must develop a vision of world security based on everyone's enjoyment of all rights and satisfaction of basic needs. A world which recognizes that the equal and inalienable rights of all are the foundation for peace, freedom, and justice. We need a vision of multiculturalism that transcends the nation state, where peoples of the world exchange and learn from each other on an equal footing. In the West, we see trends toward restricting rights that were previously respected, not only the rights of refugees, but also the rights of those who are effectively disenfranchised by dire poverty, alienation from the dominant culture, or illiteracy. In parts of the South, there is resistance to the concept of universal individual rights, and several arguments are used. One is that certain individual rights undermine the collective nature of some cultures. Some of these rights are also seen to contradict religious or other deeply held convictions. The fact that certain rights are perceived as being based on Western liberal values, such as opposition to the death penalty and freedom to express one's sexuality, undoubtedly gives force to this view in parts of the world. Another argument is known as the full belly thesis. Simply put, it says that freedom is a luxury for the hungry masses in the developing world and can only be granted once primary needs such as food and health have been met. Proponents of this thesis point to the history of the Industrial Revolution in Europe, or the success of the four Asian dragons to vindicate their stand. Individual dissent from the collective endeavor to develop the economy to meet basic needs should, they say, be rightly quelled. Linked to this argument is the idea that it is insulting to talk about democracy and freedom of speech while people are suffering from starvation and epidemics. We must tackle these arguments head on. We must reassert that all freedoms and rights have to be protected. All are indivisible and interdependent. People need food and freedom. We should not allow ourselves to debate the relative merits of stopping torture in jail cells or feeding hungry children. Both must be done. Universality is not a given. It is a struggle to achieve it, and it is sanctioned by international human rights law that developed through cooperation of states and non-government organizations. It is vital that there be no retreat from the arguments about universality and indivisibility of human rights. In Vienna, the conference held the line, but we need to do more than just hold the line. We need, as I've said, a new and broader vision of the possibilities open to humanity. And armed with this vision, we can offer action and activism as the antidotes to despair. We can mobilize millions of people to overcome the passivity which lets governments off the hook. For us at Amnesty International, the struggle against human rights violations is a mass struggle. Every member, every group of Amnesty is a leader in the campaign to stop abuses. And my task at the center of this extensive network is to ensure that although we speak with many voices and in many languages, we have one message: stop the violations. We need to make sure that all our members, whether based in a remote village or in a busy metropolis, have the expertise, the tools, and the confidence to take full advantage of the opportunities to work for human rights. Since our foundation in 1961, we have built the first mass international human rights movement. Faced with human rights disasters, we must escalate our work. We must build on our strengths and never be afraid to adapt to the constantly changing world in which we live in. To be as effective as possible, we must take full advantage of today's information technology. Information is the lifeblood of the human rights movement. Suppression of information has always been a key weapon in the armory of repressive governments. We should be at the cutting edge of new technology and turn that technology into a weapon in our armory. And the new telecommunication technology opens up exciting new opportunities for us. We can receive more information more quickly. We can check it more easily. We can process it so that it can be used more effectively and by more people. And then we can redirect it to all corners of the world. The fact that there are cheap and continuous ways of keeping in touch with all corners of the world also allows us to offer greater protection to those in the front line of monitoring human rights. These are the people who risk their lives and freedom for other people's human rights. Human rights activists, human rights defenders are often victimized because their work removes the veil of respectability nurtured by their governments. They are the lawyers, the teachers, the doctors, the journalists, the peasant leaders, the students, the relatives of victims, and many others who promote knowledge of human rights, who monitor government actions, collate information on human rights violations, take legal action against the perpetrators, provide assistance to the victims, mobilize their communities in campaign to stop the violation. In short, they work to protect the weak and hold the powerful to account. In many countries, the human rights defenders are the only force standing between the mass of ordinary people and the unbridled power of the state. No one else would take up the cases of peasants wrongly evicted from their land. No one else will petition the courts to obtain releases of those unlawfully imprisoned. No one else will try to find out what had happened to the men and women who disappear after being seized from their homes by the military. And no one else would gather the information and pass it on to those of us elsewhere in the world who can then act on it. Human rights activists on the ground are the primary source of data about what is really happening in any particular country. International organizations, whether they be non-governmental like Amnesty or governmental like the United Nations, are dependent on that information. We know that governments which are responsible for human rights violations cannot be trusted to provide the whole truth. And without the local and independent sources, they would get away with far more than they do at the moment. The contribution of these activists has rarely been more needed than it is today. In a world experiencing rapid political change, they can help create the space in which the institutions of civil society can be built and within which the right to dissent can be exercised and protected. Yet, all too often, it has been the human rights activists who have been the first victims in times of tension, turned on by governments who see them as part of the problem instead of seeing them as part of the solution. International organizations have to take collective responsibility for the defense of human rights defenders in all corners of the globe. Those who can operate in relative safety must protect those who are most vulnerable. More effective links must be forged between individuals who risk their lives or liberty if they speak out and those who are able to publicize human rights issues and apply pressure on repressive governments. Human rights activists around the world have too often been left to their own devices, surviving through sheer grit and courage. The international community has singularly failed to do what is needed to protect them. For more than 8 years, governments at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights have been unable to reach agreement on the text of a basic declaration aimed at recognizing and protecting the rights of human rights defenders. Meanwhile, those defenders continue to be tortured, imprisoned, disappeared, and gunned down. Amnesty is urging governments to agree on a strong text of this Declaration on Human Rights Defenders and to adopt it as a matter of urgency. The forging of stronger links between all those involved in human rights work around the world is just one part of Amnesty's agenda in the 90s, which was drawn up at our 1993 International Council meeting. That agenda reaffirmed our commitment to contribute to the global human rights movement by stimulating international activism against violations of certain civil and political rights. We will continue to research, expose, and campaign against human rights abuses in every single country of the world, whoever is the guilty part. No government can feel that they are out of reach of Amnesty International. Let me now conclude this address by insisting on the need for action. 50 years ago, a German pastor called Martin Niemöller wrote the now famous lines about the criminal passivity that made the Nazi Holocaust possible. I'm sure you are all familiar with this, but with these lines, but I want to repeat them again because they are very relevant today. He wrote, "In Germany, the Nazis came for the communists. I didn't speak up because I was not a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I was a Protestant, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for me. By that time, there was no one to speak up for anyone. Humanity today has equipped itself with the essential legal frameworks of rights that guarantees the minimum existential needs and basic freedoms for everyone, everywhere. The challenge is to implement this framework, to overcome the disillusionment with government's failure to fulfill the basic expectations of humanity. The solutions is through renewed solidarity and action. Action to educate and inform the public. Action to call on all individuals to fulfill their human obligations. Action to ensure that the links that bind humanity together are never broken again. Action to protect the defenders of human rights victims before they become victims themselves, because if they become victims, then there will be nobody to defend the victims. Action to turn information technology into a weapon in our armory. We must do this so that as we enter the 21st century, no one anywhere can say, I did not know. No one anywhere can say, I did not know what my responsibilities were. No one anywhere can say, I did not know what to do. In this last decade of our millennium, Amnesty International has committed itself to the goal of global mobilization in order to bring reality closer to the aspiration of humanity and the vision of Franklin Roosevelt. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Pierce. I know you'd all agree with me that that was a very inspiring and forthright address. Not so much to people here, but to the world at large as well. We normally take one or two questions at the end of this, end of a public lecture, and therefore I would like to invite any questions if there are. Yes. Did people hear the question upstairs? Okay, thank you.
Well, this is probably the most difficult question that is facing human rights organizations. And you can answer that questions from different angles. if you take reference as your reference, your starting point, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you have an article in the Universal Declaration which says that nothing in this declaration should be taken to mean or to justify the denial of the rights that are enshrined in the declaration. Obviously, it is difficult to campaign for the rights of those who have a clear political agenda, which is the suppression of all human rights. But at the same time, they have the right to do it. They have the right of free expression. They have the right to organize peacefully. They have the right to organize in order to conquer state power. And that is in that was in the constitution in Algeria. And that is part of many of the international instruments that have been signed. Now, whether they would have suppressed actually rights after they were in power, that is speculation. And it is the Democrats in Algeria who justify the security apparatus in order to defend democracy play with fire. We've seen it in Latin America where Democrats called in the military in order to protect society from the red terrorists. We've seen it in Argentina, we've seen it in Uruguay, we've seen it in Chile. And what has happened is fascist regime who suppressed not only the freedom of the so-called red terrorists, but who took the whole society hostage. So there's no easy answer. And in Amnesty, we questions. The only thing we are saying is that our work is focused on specific violations that are committed by government and by armed opposition groups. And we are campaigning for an end to those violations. And we are saying, therefore, that the Islamic militants who in Algeria are fighting for what they believe is the right form of democracy, given their culture and religion, have the right not to be tortured, have the right not to be executed extrajudicially in the streets, should not be hanged even if they are found guilty of having committed crimes, that they have the same rights as everybody else, as individuals. Now, in terms of their own political agenda, we don't take side on that. We never take sides on political agendas. But we would only adopt them as prisoners of conscience, which is those that we ask, for whom we ask immediate and unconditional release if they don't preach violence. And since most of them would be not only preaching violence but engaging in acts of violence, we would not consider them as prisoners of conscience, but they would be considered as political prisoners. And they are entitled to a fair trial, and they should be treated with human dignity, basically.
One more question?
Yes.
I feel to declare where I stand on the campaign against militarism, and we've been quite critical of Amnesty over the last couple of years. And my question is really, I suppose, directly linked to when you say you won't take sides. So you say that you'd like to...
Well, Taking sides means that you are absolutely convinced that the side you are taking is the right side. How would you know? I mean, you know, what could be the truth today, tomorrow maybe, you know, people realize that actually they were wrong. And we see, almost half of the world half of the former Marxist intellectuals today saying that they were wrong. What they believed yesterday is, you know, they were. So it's difficult to know which side is the right side and which side is the wrong side. And our work is based on the long term. What we want to do is to make sure that whoever wants to take side is capable of doing it. We fight for a space where people can take whichever sides they want. If we are to take side, it will be difficult to ensure that you will have this space where everybody can take the side that he or she wants. And you can only do that if you take an impartial stand and fight for the respect of these basic rights so that debate can take place in society and that democratically people can select whatever they want and democratically they can make mistakes if they want. So that's the side that we take. We take the side of impartiality in these debates.
I think I will not take any more questions, partly because this has been a splendid lecture and Pierre Senne has answered two questions, but also because in the interest of not only humanity but the arts, there is about to take place a Shakespeare performance this evening. An anxious student came to me and said, how long are you going to go on? We've got important things to do. So I thank Pierre Senne again. Thank you all for coming.